We'll now move on to agenda item four. Just to give you a sense of where we are on the time. We are running late, but this is a really important discussion, and so is the next one. So the thing I want to what we'll come back to is making sure we're on time, because the Zoom meeting really requires that in terms of our logistics and planning with others who will be presenting. So we'll be back on schedule at 12:30. We may go over a bit with the next item about the DOJ memorandum on statutory authority related to carbon and climate. That's how we'll make it up, which I wouldn't think would be a big problem, because you can grab a sandwich while we're having the, if we go a little long on this one, and you don't have quite enough time to get lunch, you can continue to have it while we're reconvening at 12:30. So if that makes any sense, we'll turn this over to Matt and Danny Norlander and John DeKarzik. Are you kicking this off? That's what my note indicates. Yes, okay.
I am. Thank
yes,
you.
Good. Thank you. I see you there now.
Chair Imason, members of the board, State Forester Dougherty, I appreciate the opportunity to bring back Matt DeVore from the Department of Justice, who has prepared a response relative to the climate and carbon authority questions that the board put forward in previous months. Danny Norlander has been the lead on this item and carrying it forward, and to move it forward, I will turn to Danny.
Good morning, Chair Imason, board members, and State Forest Authority. For the record, I am Danny Norlander, and my position is the Forest Carbon Forest Health Policy Analyst at ODF. Agenda item four brings the memorandum that the Department of Justice has prepared in response to the statutory authority questions that were finalized at the June meeting. This is a process that began roughly a year ago when staff began to draft the board's climate change work plan, and that was approved at the March meeting. I would like to remind everybody that this process is separate from work that the department has been doing as directed in Executive Order 2004, but the contents of this memo may have overlap with some of the work that is being done for the executive order. I hope that today's presentation and the following discussion that the board will have a greater understanding of the statutory sideboards when setting policy direction for the department and the forest sector in general. Additionally, it will provide a base for other items in the climate change and overarching work plans, including future consideration of Forest Practice Act rules as they relate to climate change. Discussion of the rule analysis work will take place at future meetings. So with that, are there any questions about what has taken place and the process that has gotten us to this point?
I don't see any hands up at the moment, so we can continue.
All right. So with that, I want to turn it over to Matt DeVore from the Department of Justice. So go ahead, Matt.
Great. Thank you, Danny. Chair Imason, members of the board, thank you for allowing me to be here this morning. I have a slideshow that goes through the questions in the memorandum, and this is all going to be a discussion of what's in the memorandum, so I'll try to step through it a little bit quicker than you had allotted for the on the agenda and see if we can help to make up some time. But I'll start with trying to share my screen. And does the sharing work there?
That looks good to me.
Okay. All right. So as Danny mentioned, over the last several months, the Board of Forestry has been discussing its authority to address climate change and asking a series of questions that were formalized into a series of eight questions in June. I prepared a brief memo that specifically addressed those questions, along with a longer appendix that provided excerpts of the relevant legislative history. The board and the department asked that the memo be prepared for public disclosure, and that the intent there was that such disclosure would not be and should not be considered to be a waiver of the attorney-client privilege as to any of the communications that are the subject of that memo. So as I began working on responses to the board's questions, I started with the basic legal principle that a board, as with any statutory body, can only undertake the actions that it has been authorized to take. So for the Board of Forestry, its authority is found in legislative acts, primarily the statutes. So in order for the board to take a particular action, it needs to be able to base that action on a specific statutory authority. Each of the board's questions was paired with a specific statute, and my responses in the memo focus on those statutes, and in some situations, they also expand over to some closely related statutes that provide a little bit more context to explain the board's authority. That being said, the responses focused on the statutes in ORS 526 and 527, with a primary focus on the board's authority to regulate private forest lands under the Forest Practices Act. As we discussed with the fire prevention and suppression efforts, this memo does not go into ORS 477 or the forest protection rules, and it does not go into the board's authority under state forest management either. As I was reviewing the text of the statutes, I also researched the legislative history as it was available and helpful to the responses. In some situations where the legislative history was particularly helpful, I copied the relevant deliberations into an appendix that is attached to the memo. So this morning, my hope is to walk through each of the questions, to provide a quick response as written out in the memo, and encourage any questions along the way as we step through each question. So with that, the first question was, does the Board of Forestry's authority to supervise all matters of forest policy and management include establishing climate change and forest carbon goals? The cited statute is 526.016, which is very broad and comprehensive. It would include the authority to establish climate change and forest carbon goals to the extent that these goals are part of supervision of forest policy and management. The authority can be implemented in the board through its rulemaking. And some of that may, I don't want it to sound like a circular answer where we say, yes, you can do it as long as you comply with the statute. But when you're looking at what goals and what policy decisions you want to make, it would be helpful to have a more concrete idea of what those policies and goals are in order to ensure that it's consistent with what the authority is in the statute. So I'll pause there at the end of question one if there's any questions. Otherwise, I'll move on to the second question.
Again, I'm not seeing any right now, Matt, so you can keep going, and if there's a clarifying question that any of the board members have, please just go ahead and raise the hand and I will call on it. Otherwise, we'll have, you know, maybe broader discussion at the end. Thanks.
Great, thank you, Chair Emerson. So the second question is, net carbon storage and sequestration included in management of all forest lands in Oregon should be encouraged to provide continuous production of all forest benefits. And the cited statute is 526.460, which was part of the Woodlands Management Act of 1979. And the focus of the Woodlands Management Act was a little bit more narrow than that broad policy statement would suggest. So the legislative hearings focused on increasing timber productivity and providing financial incentives to encourage small woodland owners to maintain their lands as woodlands. There were several policy statements written in about the environmental benefits and providing continuous production for all forest benefits, including air resources. And that is stated in 526.460 subsection 1, as well as subsection 2. The other provisions in the Woodland Management Act that do provide specific authority for the forester and the board to act are more limited to establishing a forest tree seed bank and a tree seed orchard. So these are the two ways that the board and the forester are authorized to implement the policy decisions in the Woodland Management Act. So even though 526.460 doesn't have a broad authority to act, There are other provisions, such as the ORS 526.016 that we discussed in question one, that does include broader authority to supervise all matters of forest policy and management, which could include net carbon storage and sequestration to the extent that those rules and policies focus on forest policy and management. And I'll also, in some later slides, talk about a couple other statutes, including 527.630. That statute encourages the economically efficient forest practices that ensure continuous growing and harvesting of forestry species. And it also provides that such rules have to be consistent with the sound management of soil, air, water, fish, and wildlife resources. That's another very broad authority, which combined with the board's rulemaking authority, could include carbon storage and sequestration. Also under ORS 527.710, which we'll discuss later as well, the board is obligated to set standards for forest practices that provide for the overall maintenance of air quality, water resources, soil productivity, and fish and wildlife. And the board could find that carbon storage and sequestration must be taken into account in order to maintain or provide for the overall maintenance of these resources. So the Woodland Management Act is a little bit more narrow. It has a nice broad policy statement, but the authority to act is more limited under that specific statute. And I'll pause there before going on to question three.
You can keep going.
Okay. Question three, does the board have authority to include harvested wood products in policy development related to climate change and forest carbon? Again, the same statutes that were cited in question number one. The authority in this statute applies to regulation of forest policy and management. It doesn't specifically provide authority to regulate activities that are beyond forest policy and management. So there may be some gray area, but broadly speaking, the further that the wood products become separated from forest policy and management, the more tenuous that authority would become. Even if regulation of wood products is not within the scope of forest policy and management, it would not preclude the board from considering carbon storage of potential, the carbon storage potential of harvested wood products as part of its evaluation of the impact of forest practices and the management on net carbon storage. So information about the ability of those products to store carbon could help to inform the board's policy decisions on how best to supervise forest policy and management that provide for overall maintenance of resources, including air resources, as allowed under 527.710. And I'll pause there before going to question four.
It looks all clear.
Okay. Question number four, must the board consider climate change in setting policy related to maximizing forest benefits? And can those include carbon costs of harvest and processing timber removed from forest lands? And the cited statute goes back to the Woodlands Management Act, which I discussed on question two, has a limited scope of what it authorizes the board to do. Though if we look at the other statutes, 526.016, 527.630, and 527.710, those statutes provide much broader authority. They don't necessarily require that the board consider the climate change issues, but they would authorize it. The carbon costs of harvest and processing timber could also be considered to the extent that they apply to forest policy and management in 526.016, set forest practices in 527.630, and in 527.710. And in 527.710, there is an obligation to provide for the overall maintenance of air quality. And to the extent that the board finds that climate change is a part of maintaining overall air quality, then it would be a consideration that the board must or shall consider as it sets policy. If there's no questions on that, on question number four, I'll move on to question number five.
That's fine.
Question number five, does the board have authority to regulate forest carbon under the Forest Practices Act? And the cited statute is 527.710, which is a very broad statute for establishing standards for forest products that provide for the overall maintenance of air quality. So the board would have authority here to consider forest carbon as it regulates forest practices. To the extent that such a specific regulation is necessary to provide for the overall maintenance of the resources listed. The phrase overall maintenance is an interesting phrase that received quite a bit of attention in legislative deliberations. And what the legislature consistently heard was that the intent of overall maintenance was to acknowledge that forest operations may have a temporary adverse effect on the listed resources, but that the integrity of the resource would generally be maintained over the life of the forest stand. And there are some more excerpts of the legislative deliberations on that phrase in the appendix to the memo. If there are no questions, I'll move on to number six.
You're clear to go.
Question number six, can the board adopt forest practice rules based on or including future climate projections or climate models, or does there need to be a measurable degradation currently? And the cited statute is 527.714, which sets some of the sideboards that the board has to consider as it adopts any forest practices rule. And it's my understanding that the question posed relates to new rules or new standards that would be based on statutory authority, and the criteria under 527.714 subsection 5 would need to be met. And there's two criteria in particular. Subsection A, which requires that there be monitoring or research evidence that documents degradation of resources is likely. And then criteria C, that the proposed rule reflects available scientific information, monitoring, field evaluation. Those two criteria seem like they would be the most relevant to respond to this question, though 714 does have several other sideboards. These criteria, specifically in A and C, would provide the board with authority to proceed with rulemaking that relies on projections and models of future impacts, so long as the rules are based on the evidentiary standards that are outlined in those criteria A and C. The harder question I think that the board would face is whether the evidence that it's considering is sufficiently reliable to support the projections and models. That you're familiar with the competing science on a lot of these issues, and that would be a policy decision to decide whether the monitoring and research evidence that is available would support the proposed rule. But I believe that these two criteria could be met by relying on projections and models without the specific finding of the measurable degradation that the question posed. I'll move on to number seven if there's no questions.
Yep.
So number seven was focused on the good neighbor authority, and the policy in statute authorizes pursuing projects related to a list of specific outcomes. And the question was, does this specificity limit applications to climate change? And then the two statutes cited were part of the good neighbor authority. In 526.274, the first statute provides that the board can direct the state forester to develop stewardship contracts to carry out the management activities on forest lands. And then subsections 2 through 6 also set forth other ways that the board could be involved in setting policy on federal lands. In subsection 1, the scope of what the stewardship contract agreements can entail are fairly limited. These are the specific types of projects that the forester could engage in to implement the board's policy decisions. So, if there are any questions on number 7?
I don't see any. Yes, Brenda.
Yeah, Matt, just a clarifying question, if you could please. Item G in that, thank you. Perform other activities related to stewardship and also restore wildlife habitat. If climate change were to have, be predicted to have a negative impact on wildlife habitat or other stewardship values, would that be something that would be included here, or is this specific enough that that we would not consider climate change in that regard?
The way that I believe the board would have authority here would be under subsection 1, so that the board can direct the forester to facilitate development of stewardship contracts, and the board can help, the board can guide what the goals and objectives of those contracts are. And then under 1G, perform other activities, the forester would be able to engage in stewardship contract agreements to perform any of these activities with the catch-all to perform other activities that would implement the board's goals related to climate change. Does that help to respond to the question, or did I miss it?
That's great. Thank you, Matt.
I don't see another question, Matt, so go on to 8.
Great. The final question, 8, is really a broad and all-encompassing one that I think is helpful to close on. Does the board have authority to identify and establish rules related to climate refugia to include mitigation and or adaptation for climate change? And the climate refugia and mitigation or adaptation, those are pretty specific items, but I, the way that I took this question was to expand it a little bit to say, what is the overall authority to address climate change in these two chapters? And it gives me then a chance to speak about the three statutes that I've mentioned throughout. The first one is 526.016 with the broad authority to supervise forest policy and management. It's a very broad authority that would allow the board to take actions as long as they fit within forest policy and management. The other statute, 527.630, is also a broad policy statement, and coupled with 527.715, the board has authority to make rules to implement this policy statement. And I should note, in the memo I wrote in response to question number 8, I cited 526.630, but that was incorrect. The correct citation should be the 527.630. And it provides for the policy statement that the rules should be consistent with sound management of soil, air, water, fish, and wildlife resources, and to ensure the continuous benefits of those resources. The last of the three big policy statements that are discussed throughout is 527.710, which provides there, again, for the overall maintenance of air quality. And under this, the board would have broad authority to adopt rules that implement the policy direction contained in this statute and the previous two statutes. So I want this to be a helpful discussion, but at the same time, without getting into some more details of a proposed regulation, it's hard to offer very, very concrete advice without saying, as long as your rules have that statutory hook that they can implement, they would be within the board's authority to enact. And then finally, the last point I would make is that we need to keep in mind the criteria in 527.714 subsection 5. The sideboards that the legislature set would need to be met before any rules under this category could be enacted. And they do require scientific evidence and monitoring, as we discussed earlier. So that concludes the slides that I had prepared. I'm happy to answer any questions or discuss these further if there are any points that didn't quite come across as clearly as I had hoped.
Okay. Any board members have questions or an area they want to pursue further that Matt didn't touch on specifically? Cindy.
Thank you. Matt, I've got just sort of two points of clarification to make sure that I properly heard what you said. First one is it sort of struck me that the authority that we have to consider the costs, the carbon costs of harvest, basically relies on the same argument as the authority we have to consider carbon storage in harvested wood products. Is that fair? That those two seemed like they had parallel lines of argument to me.
I think that's right. The broad policy statement in 526.016 is where I focused on in answering these two questions. And whether it's carbon storage in the forest or wood products that are they have left the forest, the 526.016 would give authority to regulate those so long as they relate to forest policy and management. So right. With carbon storage, if you're looking at storing carbon as part of a forest policy, that's where you could have your authority in 526.016. And then in the same vein with wood products, you would need to be able to tie regulation of that wood product to forest policy and management. Which okay. gets harder to do if it's more separated from the forest.
Okay, and similarly, if we want to consider and look at the carbon costs of harvest, that relies on sort of the same linkage. We have to identify how it relates to forest management if we want to look at carbon costs.
Right. No? Under the 526.016, you'd have to look at how that carbon costs of harvesting relate to forest policy and management.
Okay. And then the other, thanks. I think that means I heard you right. And then the other point was sort of relative to new regulations that we don't have to have research that demonstrates that harm already has occurred as long as we have scientific evidence to indicate that a projection of harm being likely in the future is supported.
That's right. Under the 714 subsection 5A, you would have to have found that there's monitoring or research evidence that documents degradation is likely. That doesn't necessarily mean that it shows that degradation has occurred, but future degradation is likely.
Okay.
And then in subsection C, you have to find that the rule reflects available scientific information, monitoring, field evaluation. And again, that doesn't require that there be a history of degradation, but that you're using that scientific information, monitoring, and field observations, field evaluation, mm-hmm. as the basis to support your decisions.
Good. Thank you, Matt.
Okay, Jim Kelly.
Yes, Matt, I would assume, and correct me if I'm not right, that any moves, regulatory moves that we would make related to climate change and carbon that arguably reduce property values would open us up to potential measure 49 claims. Is that correct?
The risk is there. It's been a while since I've looked at this, and when I did, it was specific to the riparian rules. And it's been long enough since I've looked at that that I wouldn't want to say more than the risk is there.
Right. And the only way we avoid that risk is if there's like federal legislation or something that we would be moving to meet. Is that correct?
That's one of the ways that a state agency could avoid the obligation to pay compensation is if it's a rule that's enacted because of federal regulations.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Any other questions from board members? Seeing none, Matt, thanks very much for your presentation, walking through this. I think it's really helpful for the board. If there's nothing more on this topic, then we'll break for lunch. We'll reconvene at 12:30 for item 5, which is the Forest Trust Land Advisory Committee testimony and the afternoon session. Thanks. And you can leave your phone, you can stay plugged into this meeting. You might want to stop video, mute.